Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Sherry Flick. Sherry Flick is the author of the award-winning flash fiction chapbook, I Call This Flirting. Her work has appeared in many literary journals and anthologies, including Norton's Flash Fiction Forward and New Sudden Fiction. A recipient of a Pennsylvania Council on the Arts Fellowship, she works in Pittsburgh as a freelance writer and artistic director for the Gist Street Reading Series. She will read tonight from her novel, Reconsidering Happiness, published by University of Nebraska Press. Welcome to Prosody, Sherry.
Hi, Ellen.
How about we start out tonight with you reading a little bit?
Okay. I'm going to read from nearly the very beginning of the book. Just like that, Vivette was driving through Bucyrus, Ohio. The land turned from rocky, hilly east to something flat as a pancake. Silos sprouted along the pastures. Water towers loomed. Cornstalk stumps mishmashed in the fields like crooked razor stubble. Vivette sped on by. Then, at the Mayflower Bar and Grill in Plymouth, Indiana, Vivette did not, as she hoped, find a grill. Instead, thumbtacked to a post, there was a thin paper square that read, Tuna Fish Sandwich, $1.75. As she sat at the bar writing a postcard, surrounded by knotty pine walls and bustling small-town conversation, construction workers cashed paychecks with one of the two cute blondes behind the bar, the cash register already loaded down with $20 bills in anticipation of the rush. Under Vivette's forearms, a wooden bar stretched with thousands of names carved into it. Vivette on the road, Vivette scratched into the wood, tracing over the letters with her ballpoint pen. Two plastic models of the Mayflower sailed along top of a beer case packed shoulder to shoulder with bottles of Budweiser, along with replicas of the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria. The rough and rugged man beside Vivette talked to no one in particular about the option of doing community service versus time. As the noise in the bar increased, she thought about doing time, what it meant to a person who'd pulled up her roots. Postcards sent and received, mile markers passed. She mulled it over, content to be invisible. She drank her beer and ate her sandwich, white bread, tuna fish. After the Mayflower, she was back on the road, past tidy houses with uptight porches. Vivette eased by chubby citizens wearing practical clothing who stood looking lost in their rectangular yards. She made for the Mississippi River, like so many before her. Even in the haze of her endless driving, it was clear the river saved the country from its own monotony. Her car hovered above the roadway, and Vivette was flying in the midst of her own momentum. The flat, easy horizon, a red pickup in a cornfield, a tractor trailer at rest on a rise. Ribbons of dirt roads to the left and right led to gullies and ravines and farmsteads with stacks of firewood on little islands in an endless sea of cornstalks. Her world was confined by a solid white line to the right and a dotted one to the left. The longer she drove, the more the idea of never stopping, the ease of stepping on the gas, made sense.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Sherry Flick, reading from her novel, Reconsidering Happiness, just released by University of Nebraska Press. So Sherry, in the book, there's a lot of landscape, various landscapes we're in. I mean, you really do kind of, you take the whole country on. We've got San Francisco, we've got Nebraska, we've got New England, you know, we're kind of coast to coast. And I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about your characters in the landscape. I think, you know, one of the things I was noticing as I was reading is it's the idea of almost putting yourself in a different landscape to see what you can learn about yourself, almost in a way more so than what you learn about the territory around you. Is kind of like, do I fit in here or do I not fit in here? And your characters seem to be doing that, you know, in a number of different ways because they keep kind of moving around. So I just wanted to ask you about, you know, kind of your use of, it's not just backdrop.
No, I think the landscape is almost a character, or, you know, several different characters in a book with a lot of characters already. And part of what I was examining is the whole idea that in America. We have all these different cultures that exist within the same country. And I think if people haven't traveled a lot or have maybe just traveled through places but not actually lived in a place for a while, they don't totally understand the culture. And part of what I wanted to explore is how culture affects personality. And we also get hybrids. So you have in this book, you have some couple characters who grew up in Ohio and Pennsylvania, kind of became New Englanders, and then eventually are plopping themselves into the Great Plains. And how does that affect personality? That's, you know, the question I was asking myself. And it creates conflict, you know, it's natural conflict in a plot, I guess, to, you know, kind of have these people trying to negotiate space.
And yeah, and I think also, particularly in the Great Plains section, in the sections when we're in Nebraska, I think there's a way that they're thinking about themselves in the context of history, too, that is harder, I think, in more developed landscapes. So in Pittsburgh or, you know, in Chicago, where I'm from, it's, even though you try to imagine it, it's really hard to imagine, like, what was it like when the first people really got here? Because there's just so much. But I think out in the Great Plains, it's like, yeah, it pretty much probably didn't look a whole heck of a lot different than it does now.
Yeah, it fascinated me. I moved to Nebraska for grad school. And when I was accepted to grad school, I was living in San Francisco. Hmm. And I said yes over the phone and got in my car. And I drove to the Great Plains, which is a place I had driven through many times. And I thought, oh, this will be cool. There'll be cowboys and good thrift stores. And I didn't think about the culture shock that I was about to experience. And so when I arrived there, that was the first thing that hit me, was that idea of history. And I started immediately thinking about the concept of pioneers. Mm-hmm. And started reading actually letters of women pioneers. There are these great collections of letters from diaries that people kept as they went across the country. And my big question became, who left and who stayed? Who becomes a pioneer and who stays on the East Coast, you know, who doesn't get into the prairie schooner. And so that kind of fascinated me while I lived there. And then with my characters in this book, I can kind of consider them contemporary pioneers getting in their cars and driving, you know,
sure,
leaving. And what does that mean, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting recurring, you know, there's a number of recurring themes that kind of thread through the book about that idea of who stays and who goes. And I think that's what I was kind of trying to get at, whether I did it well or not. Earlier, my question is just this idea of kind of picturing yourself in the landscape, like, is this enough to keep me here or do I need to keep going?
Right. How do you find contentment? You know, I think some people, I don't know, the concept of contentment is intriguing to me because I think we try to simplify it. It means, you know, oftentimes we think, oh, contentment means we've settled down. But for some people, the idea of moving is contentment. That idea of leaving is a kind of peace and a momentum. And so that's part of the contrast between Vivette and Margaret, the two characters. Margaret has sort of decided to stay and Vivette is heading out.
Right. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Sherry Flick, reading from her novel, Reconsidering Happiness. Sherry, you want to read a little bit more?
Sure. The first time Margaret visited her friends, Susan and Robert, she drove to New Hampshire for a long weekend, a way of cutting the strings with her college years. In her phone message confirming her visit, Margaret said, I'm in need of a spontaneous geographic relocation. See you tomorrow. She applied rum raisin lipstick, wore a Clash t-shirt that a roommate had given her for Christmas, and laced up the Doc Marten boots she'd bought with graduation cash. With Robert and Susan at work, Margaret wandered out on her own that first day, down Portsmouth's sunny brick streets and around the town square. People gathered on park benches and around outdoor cafe tables. A guy in a baggy plaid cardigan, sweater, and thick black eyeglasses looked up at her and smiled. Margaret asked him for directions to the pier. Later, he would be her friend, Scott. She arrived at Susan's place with no real plan, but feared she'd end up back in Boardman, Ohio, in her childhood bedroom, with its assortment of teddy bears and pink ruffles, slowly suffocating, waitressing at the local diner with her communications degree stuffed into her back pocket. Jocks she went to high school with would demand more coffee, then try to look down the front of her uniform as she poured. She ambled the narrow street speckled with sunshine. The Piscataqua River swirled below her with sailboats and tugboats moving along, the drawbridge sliding up with bells and whistles. Photography studios, bookstores, galleries, and biker bars all shouldered each other along the tiny, crowded blocks. Where State Street intersected with Penn Hollow, she came across a bright pink building. Along the front were two park benches, and beside each one was a flower box, herbs and pansies, an abandoned pinwheel spinning in one. The early afternoon sun hit like a spotlight across the gold letters that spelled out Penn Hollow Bakery. The wooden case boasted jumbles of scones and rolls and 20 different kinds of cookies, each in their own basket with a handmade sign. Behind the counter, a metal rack propped up the day's bread selections. Onion dill, anadama, oatmeal molasses, crusty white, and whole wheat baguettes. A warm sesame wheat roll came with Margaret's split pea soup. The sun filtered through the front windows. The bakery was vibrant. The smell of simmering soup mixed with music and the tabletops covered with Mexican tiles. Women with strong arms and kind faces moved swiftly behind the counter, chocolate and flour smudged across their aprons. They worked through the lunch rush, taking turns eating bowls of soup on the big wooden table near the ovens. They propped their feet up on colorful plastic barrels labeled flour, cornmeal, and oats, and yelled goodbye as customers ran out the door. A whole new idea for Margaret's future took hold that day, one that had nothing to do with the career track or the board game Life that she'd played as a kid, where you spun a dial and married, and then added little pink and blue baby pegs to a blue or green or red sedan as it drove toward retirement. Margaret spotted a handwritten sign on a cheap paper plate that read, "Counterperson wanted, needed. You don't know what love is until you put one of these aprons on and step behind the counter." Hand-drawn flowers circled its rim. The stick figures in the center wore blue aprons, smiled, waving hello. Margaret bought 2 baguettes, 9 cocoa butter hearts, and 3 pounds of wild mushroom linguine for the dinner she planned to make Robert and Susan. The woman behind the counter had brown curly hair and a makeshift bun kept in place with various pens and pencils. When Margaret asked for an application, leaning against the back counter, drinking coffee, the woman said, "Sure. Give it your best shot." She handed Margaret a brown paper bag and a pen. "Tell us what you want us to know." "Hi, I'm Margaret," she said. "Gert. Good luck." Back at her table, Margaret drew a quick sketch of herself in an apron with a bubble coming out of her mouth that said, "I love food. I really want this job. Please don't send me back to Ohio in my childhood room filled with pink gingham, Holly Hobby sheets, and half-used Love's Baby Soft bottles." She scribbled Susan and Robert's phone number at the bottom.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Sherry Flick, reading from her novel Reconsidering Happiness, out from University of Nebraska Press. Okay, except for the Holly Hobby sheets, that was my bedroom growing up. And I also know the terror of, please don't send me back to that place.
It won't end well.
I think I should, I feel like I should offer a warning to readers in this, in a really good way, that don't read this book hungry. It's kind of like going to see the movie Julie and Julia.
Get a snack. Sit down with a snack. Yeah.
Because there's a lot of really luscious, savory food in again, it's like kind of, it's not just part of the landscape. It's like part of what shapes the spaces, the interactions, the characters. I know you also have a blog, Food and Sentences. So I just wanted you to talk a little bit about, you know, that how food kind of plays a role in your sense, I think, of the world.
Yeah, I think, well, in this book and probably in my life, you know, food is this great connector. Can be collaborative if people are cooking together. In the book, Penn Hollow Bakery becomes the community. It's the community hub. And so people come there to celebrate and they come there to mourn. It's just a place where emotion and food are very entangled. And I feel like, yeah, that's an important aspect of culture that maybe is really coming into all of the U.S. at this point, but the East and West Coast were, you know, sort of advanced in their foodiness. And I lived in both those places and just had this experience of really starting to understand the importance of food and how it brings people together.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a way, it is, as you're saying, it's a way of making connections. Another way that I saw food being used, actually, I think I wanted to ask you a question because you've got kind of a long history of writing flash fiction, short pieces.
Right.
And now this is a novel.
It's much longer.
But I really felt a sense, and so I wanted to see if this was something that is true or I'm just making it up, that your attention to detail, you know, the things about it's not just a lemon tart. Like, we watch this lemon tart like baking, and I'm like, oh, my Lord, I have to learn how to make a lemon tart. It's the details of the, you know, how the note is written, the sign for the tuna fish sandwiches. To me, that's a real lens that is developed in writing short, tight pieces. But I felt like you used that tool in order to move to a larger palette with this novel. And so I just wanted to ask about kind of that shift for you.
Yeah, that was the huge challenge. Most of the stories I had written before I wrote the novel were 500 words or less. And the novel is about 67,000 words, just to give the example of the contrast there. So part of what I did when I challenged myself to write a novel was I started really looking at the idea of the sentence. And with flash fiction, very short fiction, oftentimes there's sort of a need to use really short, concise sentences just because of the way the world is condensed. And so what I started doing was figuring out how to expand my sentences so they actually contained a kind of momentum. And I think, so I used my skills that I had learned at the sentence level with flash fiction, but then really just kind of studied the sentence for quite a few years to figure out how it could all fit together and be long. but I do think you're right. Part of that took me further into detail, which is kind of interesting. Instead of taking me further into plot, it kind of took me inside the detail of a scene and how can you evoke that and yet still keep a kind of momentum and plot going in a longer piece.
Yeah, because even, you know, as we've already talked about kind of broad landscape, you know, this novel moves around. It moves in time. We meet the characters kind of at the present moment and then we go back into some of their history. But what I also really liked about the way you structured that was instead of and again, I think this might be from your flash fiction background. Instead of going into a flashback, which is more traditional,
right.
You know, and kind of like, and then use that to move the story forward, you actually took us back, like kind of put the seed for that moment. And then later in the book, you fully blow out that scene so that we're kind of in these simultaneous time frames. But it really, it felt like it wasn't just flashback, just like, oh, because I need to move the narrative forward in this kind of plot-based way.
Good. I'm glad that you said that. it worked. No, I was really trying to keep the whole book really active so that even the scenes in the past weren't, it wasn't so much that, oh, let's step back and let me give you some information. It was like, this was also happening and it was important and it created this person. And so it's sort of how we think in our lives. You know, I'll be sitting here talking to you in this radio station and I'm thinking about, you know, whatever, my mother or something. You know, there's always these simultaneous memories, and that's part of what I wanted to try to capture, but in a really active way.
And it does tie back to food. You have a great kind of analogy in there about the ingredients that are in us people, like recipes. And it's true. It's like, here are the ingredients that cause me to be this person, this character, to be that particular way.
Right.
And
it's unfortunate we don't have the list like on a t-shirt that we can walk around on to say, hey, look, this is what I've been through to make me. Yeah, right. So I was trying to build that list right through the sections of the book.
Yeah, I think you did it really well. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Sherry Flick, reading from her novel Reconsidering Happiness. Sherry, you want to read a bit more?
Yes. Oh, okay. I have that place marked, actually. I thought I did, about the ingredients
Excellent.
That you had just talked about. So I'll read that section. Margaret listens to Peter's breathing, a slight whistle on the exhale. The morning light, so distinct as it settles across the Great Plains, creeps in as the clock blinks 7 a.m. The steady weight is at her chest again, pushing gently but firmly on her lungs, keeping her from pulling in enough air. Panic hovers nearby like a lost dog. For the past hour or more, she has listened to Vivette shuffling through the house from bedroom to kitchen to bathroom to front porch to car, creaking floorboards, the click of doors, tapping, stomping, the tiny determined motor of the coffee grinder whining, silence. It's Vivette's second morning. Margaret likes to give guests private time because she knows it's what she'd want. Time to think, to digest the previous day's explorations and conversations. Margaret needs time away from people to understand them. She wonders what Vivette, a person who seems to only live for the moment, thinks about her. Yesterday in the kitchen, when she wore Margaret's jacket and was humming that silly song, for Margaret it was like gazing across years and seeing herself, young and cocky and mocking the world, cynical, judgmental, Vivette humming and bored, standing there, waiting for coffee. The pressure continues, now a wide rubber band squeezing Margaret's chest, pulling in her ribs. She tries to breathe evenly, focusing, in, out. The anxiety attacks began out of the blue when she arrived in Lincoln. At first she thought she was having a heart attack, but then she realized this thing that had her lying in a darkened bedroom, panting in physical misery, was emotional, a mini nervous breakdown. Nothing to worry about, the doctor reassured her. Very minor, he said. Margaret's mind and body decided one day she didn't like to have people in her house, that she needed to worry about both big things and little things. None of this existed in her previous life. She could go anywhere, meet anyone, make her way without second thoughts. Margaret now needs to monitor her contact with people the way others ration alcohol intake. If she binges at a party, socializing without a care, she pays for it the next day, curled in bed, door closed. She has to clear her mind, think happy thoughts. Margaret's life contracted over the years, in and in, repercussions, compromises, obligations. She read somewhere that anxiety is just unprocessed fear, but she fears the unknown, so where does that leave her? Before, she was simple and the world was in disorder, everything unknown a challenge, something new to discover and explore and put together. Now she's complicated, a puzzle to herself, and the world around her is flat. Growing up, Margaret never felt connected to her hometown in Ohio. It was just the place she was from. Once she'd resettled and claimed New Hampshire, the connection she felt there, needing a place so badly, the ocean and her friends, felt like a trap. They scared her. Leaving was easier than coming to terms with that kind of happiness. Portsmouth was just one place, and she needed to be a part of everything all at once. For a long while, floating above it all was the most consolation Margaret could find. Now she loves her life at the farmhouse, loves Peter. He isn't like most guys she's been with. He talks about clothes and books and movies they should drive into Lincoln to see. He doesn't have strange fetishes or unrealistic expectations. Their life together is straightforward, and this realization is shocking to her. She wonders how she has managed to travel from there to here, leaving tangled, broken parts of her old self as she went, creating a new Margaret she doesn't recognize some days. She twists flat onto her back with her hands behind her head, big inhale, a long sigh, breathe in, breathe out. All the unnamed trouble circling, taunting. Memories from her old life join noises in the kitchen. Mixer, bowl, measuring spoons against ceramic, glass, vacuum. What's going on out there? A crashing noise and the coffee grinder again. Sometimes Margaret resents that her edges don't show. She wishes people came with a list of ingredients, like the cookies she knows she shouldn't buy at the grocery store, a list people could read before judging her that shows what messed up stuff has been added to get her to this place, to make the person she is today. 4 affairs, 20 lovers, 3 long-term relationships, 40 out of 50 states, baker, temp, compulsive list maker, obsessive personality, demanding father, controlling mother, only child, the need to run away, softball team, cheerleading squad, cigarettes, whiskey with no ice, short glass. People would understand that she'd paid her dues, that happiness was a deliberate decision. They'd understand she learned the hard way. But this is the Great Plains, where secrets are kept buried deep inside and words are scarce as trees. Less said is more said. She has a good idea how she ended up here, but what kind of person chooses this place?
The title. Can you talk about that? She goes, ha-ha.
How did I find the title?
Yeah.
You know, I'm a person who really like titles. I have an attachment to certain titles that don't always necessarily have stories that go with them. So actually, Reconsidering Happiness is a title that I had that I really liked. And it wasn't originally on this manuscript. But for a period of time, what I was examining in a lot of my work was the concept of contentment and how what that means. I sort of mentioned that earlier a little bit. And then that sort of led into, well, what is happiness? And why do we just sort of take it for granted? It seems it's a very simple emotion. Oh, I'm happy now, you know. Mm-hmm. But I started like thinking about the complexity of that. You know, are you really happy? Like, were you happy then? And now you're happy now? How can that be? It's such two different times in your life. And so as soon as I put this title onto this manuscript, everything clicked. And that also helped with revision, because then I had a focus for some of the themes.
Yeah. And I think it really matched with, you know, both the style of the book, the perspective. I mean, this is a very inward looking book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the title even sets that frame from the get-go. Characters really, you know, I don't even know if they're conscious that they're looking for happiness. To me, it's almost like at a craving level. They know there's something.
Looking.
Yeah. Something. And, you know, at the end of this interview, I know everybody's going to, like, go to their refrigerator for something. We're using all these subliminal messages.
Eat
craving.
Healthy.
But that sense that you've got this hunger and you need to find something that will satiate it.
Right. And that answer is different depending upon where you are in your life.
Absolutely. Stage you're at. Well, Sherry, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
I appreciate having you here. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, an independent public radio, 91.3 WYEP.